Turn to Zechariah chapter 2. I have no idea where I was in 1977 on message number 20, but I know where I am today, which is more than a lot of preachers can say. There are three words I could say it without writing the Hebrew word on the board, but I grew up in churches where preachers could not spell cat in English, who would tell you what the Greek and the Hebrew said. And I figure that there are occasional key words in this pictorial language that you can learn to recognize, and then you can read your own commentaries and satisfy yourself that what you're being told is the truth. And then there are always those critics out there that are looking in that I like to tantalize so they will go check it out and gnash their teeth because he's right again. I've told you probably 100 times about the little woman that studied Hebrew so she could talk to the Lord in his own language when she got up there. His language will be, but I'm sure we'll understand it, being made over in his image, which has to include speaking his language. But the Hebrew language is like the English language, not like the Greek. In English, one word means many, many things. In the Greek, part of what I believe is the fullness of time, in God sending forth his fullest revelation in his Son, we have a language that ruled the world more precise than any other language ever uttered in human history. But the Hebrew language is more pictorial, more limited in number of words. The vocabulary is much smaller than the Greek or the English. The nuances make it a very wide and meaning language, but the words themselves are more limited because, like English, one word, and I usually go to post, can mean anything. And the English word post, from a fence post to mailing a letter to breakfast cereal, to the way some of my staff members move. When we play tennis. Known as posting, which demands fast movement. Fooled you on that one too, didn't I? You completely misjudge my staff that I'm beginning to fall in love with again. Only takes about 1 or 2 days of good performance, and I forget everything that they've done bad. So these Hebrew words are selected out of many because they have a wide significance or a particular tone of meaning that I want you to pay attention to. Unless somebody wants to check, then they can check them as I write them on the board, and you ought to be able to do it by now. That letter sin or shin is dependent upon where the dot is. If it's over here, it's sin, pronounced like our normal English S. The dot's up there, it's like our SH. Shikan. And the N is one of those letters that goes, and when it's the last letter of a word, it drops below the line. Otherwise, if it's contained within a word, it looks like so. This word, sha, ka, in, turn it around, sha, kan, without the vowels that are added later in the writing of the Hebrew language, were carried on verbally. And I don't really think anyone knows how the vowels were pronounced in the earliest renditions of this language, but early enough they begin to add the points and put the vowel sounds in between the consonants. And there's pretty general agreement on the vowel sounds. Shocking. With other letters in front of it, becomes tabernacle. Shocken is also at the root of the word Shekinah, a familiar word. All this is review from the last two Sundays. Then I want the word with the N at the front of the letter, Nahal. N-H-L. Or turn it around into our form of left to right. You know, we all think that we're normal and everybody else is abnormal. And it's hard to understand that one of the great difficulties that archaeologists have when they first find an ancient writing that is like a code they must break and find a way to decipher, one of the most difficult tasks is to figure out which side is up. Because some languages read up and down, some left to right, some right to left, and some as the ox plows. Back and forth, back and forth. The Hebrew reads from right to left. By the way, the Celts, think about this for a second, the Celts were the only people who wrote their Greek, no, not the only, among the very few, who wrote the Greek language from right to left instead of from left to right. Again, showing their ancient Hebrew identities. But turning this around, N-H-L, Nahal. And then another word that I want to talk about today again, one of their letters that changes when it's the last letter and this circle closes. Transliterated, Nahal, Shikan, Those are three words I'd like you to scribble in the margin of your Bible. Learn to recognize them. Copy the letters. Those are the block form, not the script form. And you'll be able to see these three letters, although the N is sometimes, since the N is shaped like that only when it's the end of a word, The inn is normally with a little longer tail at the base than it has at the top. Nahal am shakam. One of the beauties of the Hebrew language is because it is a low vocabulary language and stem or root based. When you locate these stems, being limited in number relative to more complicated languages in terms of multiplied vocabulary roots, you will be able to immediately recognize related words. Words that are built on the common stem. Greek is like that, but with more stems and more roots. So you'll be able to go behind the English and see related words. Here in Zechariah, the prophet is in his third vision, and I'm still there. I lifted up mine eyes again, second chapter, and looked, and behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand. And I've covered this. It is a measuring line. That is used to measure inheritance. And God, through the angel addressing Zechariah, stops it. Because it's not just any old measuring job. Jerusalem is being measured. And Jerusalem is God's inheritance. And God, in the process of getting a message across to the particular people of Zechariah's day, does not want the eternal message compromised. That's why he punished Moses so much for striking the rock twice. Because an eternal message was being worked out in drama of the smitten Christ, who was only to be struck once, the type of the rock from which the water came forth, in a place called Rephidim, which means place of rest. And when the people complained at a later time, God said to Moses, "Speak to the rock." Instead, Moses struck it a second time and interfered with God's revelatory plan, and he was punished severely. Again, though a message is being delivered to the people in Zechariah's day, don't allow another second of activity in this revelation that interferes with my overall plan. Oh, yeah. Nehemiah will come and will build walls. And Jerusalem has a locality and a perimeter for that period of the revelation where a city and a temple is being built again, into which Messiah in his first coming will tread. But in the process, God, who sees it all, stops this guy with a measuring line, saying, "Don't you measure my inheritance." Thanks be to God, or we might have been measured out. God had us in mind. Having stopped the measuring, "For thus saith the Lord, I'll be a wall of fire about them, and the glory in the midst of her. Ho, ho," literally come, come, "and flee." Wanuso is the word in the Hebrew, which means not so much to flee from the enemy as from the place of captivity. Again, a type of our deliverance from sin. "Flee from the land of the north, saith the Lord, for I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heaven, saith the Lord. Deliver thyself, O Zion, that dwellest with the daughter of Babylon, For thus saith the Lord of hosts, after the glory hath he sent me unto the nations which spoiled you, for he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye. I'm going to pause there, though this has all been covered, and I'm heading somewhere else, to say the word in the Hebrew is gate, gate of the eye, pupil, part of God's own body. Apple of the eye sort of gets across the idea of something that is very precious to him, and that's wonderful. But the Hebrew is even more graphic. What he's saying, I mean, I can touch you here and not get a reaction from you by poking my finger in your eye. And what is being said, in spite of how you can write songs about the poetry of the English translation, the apple of the eye, actually it was a pun in the Old Testament language, because Babylon prided itself in being the gate of Baal. And God is saying, these people of mine are the gate of the true God. They're as close to me as my own eyeball. You touch them, you poked a finger in my eye. And then the Hebrew says he will wield with force. He's going to slap the shinola out of you. What? If I walked up to you and poked you in the eye, what's the first reaction? Wow! Now, just Paul, I could preach on this, probably should. But let me just say it, I think it's one of those axiomatic truths that if you'll just pause a moment in your thinking and realize it, it's a pretty good place to be in. Pretty good place to be in. Those that go against us are poking God in the eye. Man, it just makes you want to duck and give him swinging room. Not a bad place to be. You know, it hurts when we get the attack. But how wonderful to realize we're God's eyeball in that kind of situation. He that toucheth you toucheth the pupil of my eye, the gate of my eye. For behold, I'll shake mine hand upon them, and they shall be spoiled to their servants, and ye shall know that the Lord of hosts has sent me. That's better than the hornets that first fruiters get. Sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion, for lo, I come, and I will dwell. Shocking. Root word, shocking. I will dwell. The shokinete is the full word, but shokin is in the middle of it. I will dwell in the midst of thee, saith the Lord. Well, the Jews could take that and say, wonderful. He's always dwelling in our midst, as I taught last Sunday. In the tabernacle first, and then the temple, in the city of Jerusalem. But he's going beyond that. And many nations shall be joined. Let me just say the word to you Hebrew scholars is lava, the Nephil stem, done out of grace, an act of God's grace. Many nations, goyim is the word, goyim. The Greek Septuagint version uses ethne. Ethnics, diverse ethnic groups all over the world shall be joined, lawa, as an act of God's grace to the Lord in that day, and shall be my people. And I will dwell again, Bishokanete, will dwell in the midst of thee, and thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts has sent me unto thee. Goyim, or ethnics, many nations, many diverse ethnic groups. And no trouble, these Jews, you got to help me this morning by putting yourself into the frame of reference of the Jews who had been accustomed through generations to seeing themselves as God's chosen people, separate and distinct, God's inheritance among the nations of the world. They're now going to measure that city. They get stopped. And God says, I will dwell in the midst of thee. But then he rains on their selfish parade. They can't limit God's inheritance. And many ethnics, not just Jews, many nations, many ethnics, he will dwell. They shall be joined with the Lord in that day. He will dwell in the midst of them, and they shall be my people. My people. That's the word. Oh, you'll find a couple of pages on that short little word in Hebrew lexicons. I had books stacked around me till I couldn't hardly see past them, trying to find a commentary that had the guts to apply the second alternative meaning for Om, and that's why I've written it here, so you can look for it among the commentaries. The second alternative meaning for this noun. You know what it is? Oh, you only get about, whereas peoples, as the translation of the word, peoples gets pages. You only get a little paragraph for the alternative meaning. You know what the alternative meaning is? Kinsmen. Now, people will fight harder for something after they say it than they would for the same thing if they hadn't said it. If the Old Testament scholars, including those who translated the Septuagint, had understood the Scriptures properly, they would have recognized Christ when he came. They totally missed the suffering servant Messiah presentation of Isaiah. They leaped to the good news at the end. And with their concept of God, to put it in the way more and more scholars are doing it in English letters, so it's the four consonants, Yahweh. They didn't even want to pronounce his name. Now think with me for a minute. The Jews, it's bad enough to have God dwell with them beyond their borders, and to dwell in the midst of people that were non-Jew. But to go so far is as to say that these ethnics, Goyim, Gentiles, would be God's kinsmen, is as shattering as for a fundamentalist to think Gene Scott's going to be saved. Of course, they haven't thought an accurate thought in many years. So their opinion doesn't disturb me. God's opinion is what counts. But I want you to understand, it takes some courageous breaking from the traditional view. When you got two choices with this word Om, people versus Kinsmen, kinsmen are people too, but special people. You're on safer ground, going to get in fewer theological fights if you say, people, they'll be my people. Can you imagine what the Jews would have done to Zechariah if he had said, and elaborated on the prophecy, now you've got two choices with what I'm saying. God is saying, through the prophet, he's saying, with the prefix of possessive pronoun, but the root stem of these two letters, he's saying, my kinsman? We'll give way for a while. We'll tolerate my people. That's why they couldn't see it until the apostles came along. Why Paul said, the mystery of the ages hidden God, that God chose before the worlds were formed as his inheritance people, not just the Jew, but out of every ethnic group in the world. Now let's go a step further, which is why this congregation in this place is so important. And I really want you to see this. From Isaac Richards, the councilman in Pasadena, who came to his present position after years of matriculating through a revolutionary group. In his past history, and I count him as a very close friend, and he has matured considerably from those days, but in his early days he wasn't just a radical, he was a revolutionary. Mayor Tom Bradley, who built this city by his ability to compromise among many groups without ever violating principles and bring them together. Everyone who's come to this congregation has been amazed as they've looked across it and seen the ethnic diversity sitting here in oneness. Now, as we, chosen by God to take the message to the world, this message, not even fully understood by Zechariah, what hypocrisy if we took this message to the world from a little town in Omaha with hardly a person in the congregation that even had a suntan. Do you follow me? But even more importantly, we didn't arrange it that way. And we didn't come downtown to be a mission. We came downtown to make a testimony and to bring people that were already part of our congregation that had responded to the message by television and radio to this one place to make a testimony that in the heart of this city, the upward look still remains. By the way, God was pretty smart. You know, I'm getting calls from all over how smart I was to pick this spot, to get in on the ground floor after that story on Channel 9 this week. How many of you saw Channel 9's story, part of it, David Jackson Journal, that featured Broadway and its bright future? And jaws gapped open when they saw just a short way down the street, the massive arcade and development that is up for approval this week. The $60 million development of Ira Yellen down the street at 3rd and Broadway. the news that the most expensive real estate in terms of rent in the city of Los Angeles, greater Los Angeles, is on Broadway. More expensive per square inch than Beverly Hills. And the David Jackson Journal featured this sanctuary in the second and in the closing fourth segment of the four-night series. And I look like a genius. Down there on the ground floor again. They're going to open that $60 million development in the spring of 95. The story referred to this as the core or heart of the city. That financial district's not the heart of the city. Broadway is. More people on Broadway than any place in the entire valley, shopping and moving about. That perception of crime and danger is exactly that. There is less crime per capita on Broadway than any other area in Los Angeles. And I look like a genius. Hey, I picked Hope Street. God picked Broadway. Now, wouldn't we look like a hypocrite preaching this message to the world in Oroville with 50 rednecks in the first two rows? Got here? Afro-American? I still prefer black, because black's beautiful. Persian? Iran? Or Iraq? Where? Who?
Iran.
No, sir? Scottish. Right behind you, the lady? Japanese. And the Latinos, how many of you are here? Hold your hands up. Polish. Polish. Carl Wiener. How many are here for the very first time? Stand up, please. We won't embarrass you. Just stand up if you're here for the very first time. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Welcome. You know, you may be seated. Thank you for coming. If you go to most churches in town, you may be seated. Thank you. You'll, there'll be 4 or 5 people wrestle you to the ground. Try to get you up here. Be sure and get your name and address, and your postal deliverer will hate you for 6 months as we fill your box with threats if you don't return. This is the church where if you got eyes to see and there's light that's shining, you'll come back for that reason. These are people that have gathered because they're in love with God's Word. That's why we're here. But I want you to realize, as you come to know even fuller from God's Word the nature of the message, God knew what He was doing to assemble this embryonic testimonial to what His church must be. It's not just that God chose some from every ethnic group before the world was formed. We are, by that choice, by that heritage, by that calling, His kinsmen. Understand that. I haven't even got to Nahal yet, which is inheritance. I just want to drive home the revelation of God in its totality, how that even in this archaic prophecy to a particular people, to get them inspired to do their particular part in building a temple that was to serve as part of God's revelatory plan, He would not allow anything in that prophecy that left out His ultimate glorious plan, that all these chosen ones are destined to be His kinsmen. How does this come about? The book of Ruth, I've preached on it many times, referred to it at the communion table countless times, is written to illustrate in drama the kinsman redeemer concept. In God's law, He declared it, and in one of the books of the Old Testament, He illustrates it in the story of Ruth and Boaz. All of the time, God was crafting His revelation, using people that were disobedient, but He had chosen them to be His oracle, to lay the tracks of type and shadow that point toward Christ, that add color and meaning to the wonder of God's plan. Gave the law that if you lost an inheritance, or if an inheritance was lost, whatever the cause, it could only, when that inheritance had any relationship or attached itself in any manner to a person, it could only be restored by the kinsman redeemer. A stranger couldn't do it. The inheritance was either lost forever or one near of kin had to redeem it. And to redeem means pay the price necessary to get it back. What's that bell? It's a truck backing up, isn't it? If that's one of our buses back there backing up, I pay those bus people, and you figure out a way to stop them, ushers, or make them go forward. Now, I'm coming to the reason for my message. And we have enough people to keep the kids from running off, so just relax, parents. Kinsman redeemer. Only a near of kin could redeem it. If you had no kinfolk, you couldn't get it back. And the kinsman redeemer had to have four characteristics. One, he had to be kinned, near of kin. Two, he had to have the means of redemption. Three, he had to willingly pay the price. And four, he had to actually pay it, actually redeem. Now, all through history, once God laid that law down, that was the pattern acted out in the tribes and in the nation of Israel for redeeming lost inheritances. I'm sure, with no more understanding than these people to whom Zechariah preached, that God would one day kin from every tribe and tongue, kin Himself, and redeem His kinfolk, and we would be His kinsmen. That's why, though Christ was not born on December 25th, that's why He was born. He was born in September on the Feast of the Trumpets, but that's a subject I'll deal with at another time. But the babe in the manger is necessary because, as the book of Hebrews says, we have no choice. We are flesh and blood. He did have a choice. He was not flesh and blood. He chose to become flesh and blood that he might be kin with us. From his supernatural place in glory before the incarnation and the virgin birth, for he took upon himself our flesh and blood form. By God's own law, he could not redeem us from the inheritance lost through the first Adam. He had to be our kinsman. And though he was not flesh and blood, he chose to take on himself flesh and blood. And that is the meaning of Christmas. He kinned himself to us. Being near kinsman was not sufficient. He had to have the means of deliverance. Again, God's laws flowed like drama through history. Under the old law, a husband and wife, if they divorced, neither could marry again under the old law till one died or the other. Romans 7 makes it clear. The husband of all mankind was the law, intractable, unbending, without perfection, who could only join itself with us if we rose to its standard. Christ became kinned with us and fulfilled the law, the terms, no jot or tittle of which shall pass away until all be fulfilled. Our kinsman, Jesus, is the only person in flesh and blood who perfectly kept the law, even in obedience unto death. He thus became the law, pulled out of the abstract, into flesh and blood, the law incarnate. And when he died, the law died with him, and the means of redemption, a perfect life, poured out unto death. The wages of sin is death. And as the sin of one, the first Adam, put the shadow on all of us, and we suffer the consequence of being separated from God, unable to rise to his standard, unable to even know it. The second Adam perfectly fulfilled the law, and the price of redemption, the vicarious sacrifice typified in all the blood sacrifices of the Old Testament, the lamb slain from the foundation of the world, kinned himself, fulfilled the law, giving him the means, a perfect life, to lay down. The kinsman redeemer cannot be forced. He must willingly pay the price. That's the meaning of the prayer in the garden. Nevertheless, not as I will, but thine, as he gave himself. The burnt offering in the Old Testament perfected the type through the stream of centuries. That perfect voluntary gift. The sin offering was required. The burnt offering, which typified his attitude of giving, had to be voluntary. The kinsman redeemer had to voluntarily pay the price. That was the stupidity of the Apostle Peter, who would fight. Jesus said, "For this cause I came. Don't you know I could call legions of angels to deliver me?" He willingly paid the price, and he actually died pouring out his blood to redeem us, that he might, by that act, fulfill the kinsman redeemer type and make it possible for us to be God's kinsmen eternal, no longer strangers and aliens, Zechariah saw this through the window of prophecy thousands of years ago. This moment, for the first time, one voice can tell that wonderful story to the entire world. That's what God has called us to do, that we can tell all the ethnics of the world. There's not just a diverse conglomerate that comes together in association under God. We are a family. We are His kinsmen. He makes us His dwelling place. As by faith we take this wondrous message and give ourselves in response to Him, and then we become, as His kinsmen, His nahal, His inheritance. But that's for next Sunday. Isn't it a wonderful thing that God has planned?